Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. You should hear what you're missing this week. It's an interview I did with Bernie Sanders. Members are going to be hearing that on their podcast feed. It's a one I did for the Majority Report, but you can get it served up with your healthy dose of in-depth interviews with reporters and with folks like Caleb Kane, this guy who was the subject of a New York Times feature on how he was radicalized by YouTube. All this stuff lives in the membership show. You're getting one third of the program right now. Sign up to become a member, get the full show, and get archives to 10 years worth of interviews. All searchable. Folks, what are you waiting for? It's literally a handful of change, not even a handful of change a day, but a week. Check it out, ROFpodcast.com. Your support keeps this program going. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today's show, Rachel Cohen from the American Prospect joins us to discuss why deregulations in the financial industry has led to the rise of a need for financial literacy in our school system. Caleb Kane will join us to discuss his transformation from a YouTube radical to a vocal opponent of the alt-right movement. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to analyze all the big news stories from this week. And Matt Ford from the New Republic will explain how we can fix the Supreme Court of the United States. If you're new to the show, you can find the free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are found. There's also a member show, and you can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show without commercials and free access to all of our decades-long archives. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Here to run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, we are now only a couple of weeks away from the first Democratic debates. It will happen over two nights. There will be two different debates with about 10 people each. We do not know who will be on what night with whom and whatnot. It will be supposedly randomized. One can only imagine. So that means it is not too early to be talking extensively about 2020 because really, and I feel this in some respects more than in past years, Iowa is going to make a big difference for some candidates, not as much of a big difference for other candidates, depending on where they fall, because there's so many candidates that this thing could be live for a couple of months. I mean, I think we're going to still have anyway, maybe 10 candidates as late as like January, February this year. But let's talk about Joe Biden. He is still the leader in the polling. Coming off last week was one of his, I think, worst weeks for any of the candidates that they've had. This week, I don't know. We had a poll that came out saying that he is dropped in Iowa. Bernie Sanders also has dropped in Iowa. Elizabeth Warren has gone up. Pete Buttigieg has gone up. But you still have Joe Biden sort of going around and campaigning like it's 1993.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. I mean, there are two things about Biden. The first that I think is, is, you know, probably one of the positives about him, aside from name recognition and, you know, being part of the Obama administration, good old Uncle Joe that everybody knows. I mean, all that's just sort of baked in. But I think that the one thing in his campaign that is compelling to people is that he is, you know, really strongly going after Donald Trump in language, using language that I think is appealing to a lot of Democratic voters and perhaps even some of those swing voters in the suburbs. I mean, Donald Trump is offensive to people on a really gut level, and they want to hear I think many of them want to hear candidates expressing it in those terms. So that's one of the things Biden has discovered, I think, is good for him. But it obscures a whole other side of the equation, which is extremely important, and I think an awful lot of primary voters, particularly on the liberal side and certainly the activist side, who understand that Trump is just a symptom of a greater problem. You know, he's a big symptom. I mean, a symptom that could kill you. But he is certainly, you know, he didn't just arrive wholly formed and everybody just, you know, a Trump-like figure was in the making for many, many years in the Republican Party. And Biden, just perversely, is out there saying, oh, he's just, he's an anomaly. And don't worry, they're going to have an epiphany. They know these Republicans know that what they're doing is wrong. And even to the extent that this week in D.C., he told a group, he gave a talk about this on Monday. And he said, you know, look, they know that what they're doing is wrong, and they're going to come around as soon as Trump is gone. And then he used the example of Merrick Garland to support his case, in which he said, a lot of them called me privately to tell me they were very concerned about what was going on. And it's like, I mean, you have to laugh, because, of course, that is a perfect example of everything that is wrong about the Republican Party, is the fact that they say privately that they know it's wrong and don't do anything about it. And in fact,
right, and there was no Donald Trump. People should remember, there was no Donald Trump. Trump was not even the nominee at that point.
Right, they had already gone out in this, you know, in this extreme direction of just absolute, you know, ruthless partisanship. And the idea that, Biden was there during the Obama administration. You know, we all watched it happen. And in fact, he was out there trying this over and over again. He was the one who went to the Republicans and tried to do the grand bargain deal on Social Security. And he, you know, if it weren't for the Freedom Caucus, who wouldn't take yes for an answer, that would have actually worked. And it would have been devastating for people to have, you know, he would have actually been a person to, you know, just rip a big tear in the social, in the safety net. By doing that. So, you know, Biden should know better than anybody about what these Republicans are about, because it was manifested clearly during the Obama administration. And most of the Obama administration veterans, and there was a whole article this week in the Daily Beast, quoting and speaking to someone background going, he's out of his mind. You know, there's no way that they're going to come around. We know that now. What's wrong with him?
Well, you know, I've been saying for weeks, because it's not the first time he said this. He said this like three or four weeks ago, and it didn't get that much traction. It got a brief blip, and maybe we mentioned it on the show at the time. But this is also a criticism of Obama, right? Like,
sure.
That's the funny thing that hasn't been picked up about this. I mean, if Joe Biden has the ability to make Republicans come to heel, essentially, or to function properly in the absence of Donald Trump, then what's he saying about Barack Obama? Now, you and I have our issues with Barack Obama, but certainly Joe Biden's voters don't. And it would be interesting to see if any reporters out there ask Joe Biden what is he saying about Barack Obama when he says that Joe Biden can work with Republicans without Donald Trump in a way that apparently Barack Obama could not. I'm very curious to hear that answer. But I think there's a couple other points that this statement is extremely telling and is, I think, ultimately going to be what is Joe Biden's downfall. And there's a couple of things embedded in this. I think, you know, one of them is clearly that he has a certain tin ear. You don't have to be on the left of the Democratic Party to be highly partisan and realize that Republicans are the problem, right? Like, that is not, this is not an ideological fight. This is simply one of how attuned you are to politics. And I don't think that there's really any large constituency within the Democratic Party that's going to vote in the primary that is of the mind that, yeah, we can deal with Republicans. It's just because of Donald Trump. I mean, I just find that very, very hard to believe. And so he's running for the general election. But I want to talk about one or two other points that I think are going to be very problematic for Joe Biden going forward and that are very telling about his equation that Donald Trump is an existential threat to the United States. And electing Joe Biden is how you deal with it. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more from Digby. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, in the last segment, we're talking about Joe Biden, who this week, in addition to getting in the face of a woman who was looking for someone who's more of a champion of women than Joe Biden. Joe Biden, apparently, despite the fact that holding on to the Hyde Amendment for decades and then reversing himself in 2 days after getting some criticism, was lecturing a an activist on the fact that Joe Biden's the best thing that's ever happened to a woman's right to choose. But leaving that aside for a moment, Joe Biden has this calculation that this week that he presented that Donald Trump is an existential threat to the country. This is sort of an extension or part of his argument that the Republicans are going to be fine as soon as Donald Trump is gone. And I find this argument to be sort of fascinating, right? Because if you argue that the problem with American politics today is one person and that he, Joe Biden, can fix it by beating Donald Trump, you have set up a dynamic that is actually very, in many respects, very Trump-like. But it also leaves you open within the context of the Democratic primary to a couple of candidates, at least, who are very much about building a grassroots movement, right? And because in building a movement and addressing a whole host of problems with America, it's a very fundamentally different way of looking at what is the problem and what's going to solve it. You have Biden saying the problem's one man and it's going to take one man to fix it. And you have people like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, who are out there saying, like, we have a bunch of broad proposals to deal with a bigger problem that's affecting Americans, broadly speaking, not just America, as it were. And we're building grass movements and we're organizing to deal with it. It's pretty stark choice that Democrats have to make.
Well, and it's kind of ironic, considering that Biden, first of all, Biden never went anywhere in presidential politics prior to becoming, you know, Barack Obama's vice presidential candidate. And Obama was certainly built his campaign around the idea of a movement. Yeah. I mean, it did not come to much fruition. Once they got into power, they disempowered that movement and institutionalized it in a really weird, rather ineffectual way. But it certainly that is partially how he came to power. The energy behind Obama and Biden in 2008 was very much built on that grassroots enthusiasm, and you know basically took on the establishment, which was in the person of Hillary Clinton at the time, in the primary. So it's ironic that Biden is now running just as sort of let's go back to the good old days. You know, and he kind of is. When you said that it was Trump-like, I mean, there's a lot. And I don't want to trash Biden. He may end up being the nominee, and you know, I don't want to just completely go after him on some kind of fundamental level. But it has to be said that there is a certain sameness about his approach. Now, obviously, he's not as malevolent or as stupid as Donald Trump. And he is a much more qualified person to be president. But there's this thing, you know.
And we should also say, let me just add one more thing, because I think your criticism is important, and I would agree with it. But we should also say there's also a difference between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, even if they're identical in many respects. Joe Biden is a member of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is going to act differently with Joe Biden, and is going to constrain Joe Biden in a way that you can't constrain Donald Trump. But with that said, continue, because I think your point is really...
No, and that is an excellent point, and there's a big discussion to be had overall about what that means for politics. But in this situation, I mean, I watch Biden and I see this sort of, it's that I alone can fix it, make America great again. I mean, he said, make America America again, and all this dumb right wingers went after him for saying that because they said he ripped off Michael Avenatti, which just cracks me up because, of course, Avenatti was quoting Langston Hughes' very famous poem, Let America Be America Again. But in any case, sorry for the digression. It just kind of amused me at the time. But, this is kind of what, Biden is kind of presenting himself as the flip side of Donald Trump. The older guy is going to take us back to when things were better. And he kind of, wagging his finger in the face of that woman, saying, I'm the best thing that has ever happened to women in this country. And his ongoing kind of, it's in a much more or a much less offensive sort of way, but the way he deals with women and, on the trail and just kind of always sort of making these moves that just everybody's cringing over. When I'm watching him, that's kind of what I'm seeing. He's kind of the nice Trump in a lot of ways, and I honestly don't know that that's going to be, if you like Trump, if you want Trump, you're going to go for Trump. It's not like you're not offered that choice, and I'm not sure that the Democratic base or even voters in general in America are looking for another Trump. Even a nice one. I just don't know if that's really where we're at. I think people have that most voters are probably saying, look, that didn't work out. Let's find somebody, I think more dynamic with new ideas that has a different approach to politics that is, that's over. That time period is over. Joe Biden is over. And I honestly look at him and I can't understand why he really wants to run now. He's a revered, character. He's an elder statesman. He's somebody who would, could be out there doing all kinds of things that could be really useful. But being president, why, the weird ambition that's taking him there at this, time in his life, I'm just kind of questioning. So, again, I don't want to trash the guy too much because, again, he could very well end up being the guy, and we'll have to deal with that. But nonetheless, it's very curious to me where we're sitting here is with this kind of battle of these two, grumpy old men.
Well, that's where we are for the time being. We're also at a break, so let's take that break. Digby, if you'll join me in the next hour, we've got a lot more to talk about. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back after this. Coming up, journalist Rachel Cohen will be here to tell us if teaching students in school financial literacy can substitute for enforcement of financial fraud. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop, use the coupon code MAJORITY, and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Across the country, there's been a movement to teach financial literacy to children grades K through 12. Both sides of the political aisle believe this type of education allows people to become competent economic actors. Here to discuss why this may lead to financial industries placing the blame on to consumers, Rachel Cohen from the American Prospect. So, Rachel, we have two different dynamics that are sort of working in many respects in parallel. And that is, you write, the dwindling of consumer protections and the rise, in some respects, of the push for financial literacy. And it seems very much to me that, you know, we have a similar dynamic across society many times where we look to education in some sectors to fix some underlying problems. Let's start with first what the underlying problems are.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start. I think people generally agree. They look around and they say, well, look, you know, people are being asked to make, you know, more complicated decisions. Mortgages are these, you know, convoluted vehicles, and the loans and offerings are, you know, confusing to the consumers. And so people sort of recognize, okay, we don't have secure retirements lined up. People are talking about Social Security, you know, being in a precarious point. Not that I'm saying it is. I'm just saying these are the narratives about financial insecurity. People agree that financial insecurity is happening. So the solution many people are turning to is saying, well, let's educate individuals, students, workers, so that they can make the best decisions so they will not be financially insecure. And it's sort of a disappointing outcome of where this conversation has gone.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me it's sort of stunning in many respects. I mean, because we have there is a quality to the financial industry, I guess, whether it's mortgages, whether it's loans, whether it's credit cards, for that matter, whatever type of financial transactions that people can enter into, even to the extent of things like bank fees. There seems to be that baked into the business model of finance in all of those different ways is a certain arbitrage, to use a financial term, between those who are involved in that industry and the consumer. And that arbitrage is basically just an understanding of the Byzantine rules that have been created around this, that are made to make these deals completely opaque. And that's where a lot of the profits are made, right? On the failure of people to understand exactly what they have gotten themselves into. And
absolutely.
All right, expand on that.
You know, like more, you know, like when we think about the financial crisis, these mortgage-backed securities, these vehicles, they were designed by people who were very financially literate, who were the experts in the financial services, you know, industry, and they designed them precisely to trick people. Like they knew when they were, you know, putting these products out there that people didn't understand them. And frankly, the idea that, oh, if only we had had a course in third grade or a half semester course in high school, then consumers would have been able to see through that, like senior level, top industry, you know, designing of products meant to, you know, fool people. It's just so absurd. Like the whole logic. And, you know, in my story, I cite a Senate hearing that happened in the U.S. Senate in 2012, literally titled Financial Literacy, Empowering Individuals to Stop the Next Financial Crisis, which is just, you know, insane. Like that's insane.
Well, all right, let's talk about the different areas in which there is this growth in financial mm-hmm. literacy. I mean, I think there is a very good argument that we should be teaching some measure of financial literacy to people in schools. Let's just talk about that push. I mean, because frankly, you know, it would be helpful to understand, you know, what interest rates are, what, you know, what controls them. I mean, these are all things that I didn't learn until I was well into my 30s, I think. And I still find them a little bit opaque. But that doesn't mean that I could prevent myself any more, you know, from getting ripped off by a major financial scheme. But tell us where we're seeing growth in financial literacy and where it's sort of gone off the rails.
Yeah. And so just to respond to that question, because, you know, it's a reasonable, you know, people reasonably say, well, what could hurt? Like, what is the harm of teaching someone to, you know, balance a checkbook or something about budgeting? And what is the harm there? And I think the problem is that we are going beyond that. And the people who are thinking about financial literacy are not just saying, okay, let's teach some basic concepts. They want to teach students things that will meaningfully change behavior to leave more financially secure lives, which is something that we know from decades of trying is actually really hard to do. What a lot of the studies show is that if you get the training, you know, before you're about to make a big financial decision, that is pretty helpful. But if you learn about a mortgage, you know, as an 11th grader, 10 years out before you're about to actually go get a mortgage, the idea that you'll be like empowered to not fall for the tricks that you're going to encounter a decade later when you're making your home buying decision, it's just not, you know, borne out by reality. So, and also just to also expand on your point, studies do show that actually additional math instruction has shown to help boost financial literacy. So just this idea that you need sort of a specialized personal finance course in order to help people as they grow older, you know, that's just not borne out by the research.
So, Rachel, we've established, at least the research has established, that it does not help financial literacy in terms of giving people the expertise they need when they enter into some type of arrangement or buy some financial product or take out a loan, unless they get this education right before they do it. The question I have for you is, does it hurt? I mean, do we really have enough data to have a sense of whether it's problematic to know a little bit about finance?
Yeah, and I just want to clarify a bit. So there have been a lot of studies over the past, you know, 30, 40 years on this topic. But now you have this sort of newer wave of researchers who have said, well, you know what, there are reasons why we shouldn't, why we shouldn't take some of the earlier studies so seriously. Yes, those studies, you know, showed negative results, but we shouldn't give up. So there's this push of people who say, despite the negative findings, let's keep trying. And maybe the problem is the teachers weren't equipped well enough to teach it. And maybe the problem is the topics weren't salient enough for students, and we need to focus on that. And I think the thing that came through as I was reporting is, so the people who want it to work, they're still optimistic that eventually we'll crack the code and we'll figure out how to make it work. And they say, we just need to keep trying. And they could be right. I mean, I don't know. But it's also sort of become clear that it's hard to actually think of a scenario where they would say, you know what, we've been trying for so long. Maybe we should take the bulk of the evidence and do something else. But there isn't really any of that kind of cost-benefit trade-off discussion happening. You just have people who are really enthusiastic about it and say, well, sure, we haven't seen the results we want yet, but let's just keep trying and trying and trying.
All right. Well, that leads into my next question, which I'm going to ask you after the break, because I am curious as to what the incentive structure is for those people who are convinced that financial literacy can solve the problem of the financial industry taking such great advantage of so many millions of Americans. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be back in just a moment. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop, use the coupon code MAJORITY, and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking with Rachel Cohen about her piece in The American Prospect. As consumer protections dwindle, schools push financial literacy. So, Rachel, in the last segment, you were telling us about the growth of the financial literacy market, industry, I guess, if you will. One of the things that strikes me about this, and I should also add that you let us know that the data shows that financial education doesn't really seem to work, but there's a whole group of people out there who continue to push it. Let's talk about why people might be pushing the notion of financial literacy so hard. Obviously, look, I don't think it's a bad idea for people to learn about everything, frankly. But what right. problem is this trying to solve so that we can get at the heart of it as to why some people are so adamant about solving this problem through the demand side as opposed to the supply side of the financial business?
Yeah, no, it's the most important question. I mean, I think it's obviously a very American ideal. We believe we can teach people, and education is an important sort of mechanism to better our lives. And so people say, well, there are all these problems, so let's teach our way out of it. Let's impart students and people with the skills so that they don't have problems anymore. And I agree with you. I don't think there's anything like inherently wrong with teaching certain concepts in schools. The problem is that it's grown to this point where people say, you know, and you have state legislators and federal lawmakers and state treasurers saying, we're going to teach kids so then when they go out into the world, they're not going to make the wrong choices. And the problem with that is it completely upends what's going on. It's as if people are, you know, buying predatory mortgages and being sold, you know, voracious loans because they're just, you know, uneducated and too stupid as opposed to, you know, being manipulated and defrauded. And so I think, like, the leaders of the financial literacy movement are very explicit that they're not just trying to teach things. They want to teach it to meaningfully change behavior and, you know, help people lead more financially secure lives, which sounds good. It's just that there's not a lot of evidence that the way to help people lead financially secure lives is giving them a class in 11th grade on, you know, credit cards. And we may see much more effective ways through other things that could be more politically difficult than passing a state mandate for a required course in K-12.
And before we get to those other things, because I have to say that, you know, the more that we talk about this, it sounds like what we're doing is providing teenagers with these shields that they need for this onslaught that's coming towards them. And obviously what we're not doing is saying, hey, wait a second, we have the ability to impact the onslaught side of this equation too.
Right.
So before we get to that, who are the people that are like behind this push? Like your article talks about how many different outfits are providing free courses. Like they must be getting something in return in some way. Let's talk about who these people are and what are they getting in return, or what are they forestalling?
Yes. I mean, so there are a lot of people who are interested in this. Obviously, I mean, there are people who are interested in because they truly want to help others and they think education will help and they're not convinced that the research, you know, contradicts their goals in any way. You know, like my sister is a econ PhD student and I told her I was working in the story and she was like, oh, I love that. I support that so much. And I was like, ah, I need to, you know, draw you back a little bit. Like a lot of people are just generally enthusiastic about it because it sounds like it should work. One of the people I interviewed for my story, who was a critic, Helene Olin, who's a journalist, she said, you know, when she started critiquing some of the research, you know, she was like, everyone made me feel like I was, you know, hating on apple pie. That's the sort of reaction. So there are some people like that. You know, there's a lot of bipartisan support. Democrats and Republicans both, you know, like how it sounds. But my piece also looked really closely at the fact that some of the most active backers of this movement come from the financial industry itself, banks, insurance companies, credit unions, credit card companies. All of these institutions are seeing a lot of opportunity. And, you know, if you talk to them, they'll say, well, yes, we just want to help. We think education is good. We want to help consumers, et cetera. But at the same time, those same groups are often lobbying against regulation over their industries. And so that's something I looked at in the piece. And in terms of what might be in it for them, you know, there's a lot of advantages to a bank, from a bank's perspective. If they sponsor curriculum about how to, you know, buy, you know, budget safely or use credit responsibly, they get, you know, credit. They get sort of the good PR that comes with sort of doing something for the community. They get to put their brand name inside classrooms for teachers, for students, for their parents. There's great marketing opportunities that come with that. And a lot of cash-strapped school districts don't necessarily have the money to afford fancy technology. And so banks are like, oh, well, we'll do it. And then we'll actually, that's also a nice way to get into your classrooms. Not all curriculums are sponsored by banks, and there are foundations and other groups. But one of the things I also looked at is that there are just so many different curriculum providers. No one knows who's using what. No one really knows which is best. Nobody's studying which is best. So it's just this sort of like explosion of options that is growing bigger every year, and it's pretty overwhelming.
So there's two things that occur to me, Rachel, as you tell me this. One is that these corporations see this as a good bulwark against regulation, right? If they can frame the conversation, like you say, about the problem being the failure of the individual to be able to assess when they're getting ripped off or not, essentially, if that's the problem, as opposed to the fact that we have an entire industry that in many respects as a business model is designed around the idea that we're going to rip people off, or at the very least, we're going to play on their ignorance about these issues. That's one thing, that they get to frame the argument and they get to forestall a certain amount of regulation. But as you're telling me this, the other thing that occurs to me is, like, this sounds like Camel Joe, right? Like Bank of America gets to put their financial literacy stuff in the classroom when you're a teenager. You grow up as an adult and you're like, Bank of America, I can trust them. You know, they were helping me as I was a kid. I mean, has there been any research as to, like, you know, does this end up actually hurting people?
I mean, I don't know if there's been research specifically on the that aspect, but there has been real, like, you know, a lot of psychological research on the on that exact phenomenon of, like, brands that people grow up with are brands that people then trust for life. So, yeah, I think it absolutely is a valid concern that, you know, if you have Visa or, you know, Bank of America in your classroom, you know, as your third grader, you're going to grow up and say, you know, they're out for me. They're like a Disney, you know, a brand that, right, I've known since I was a kid, for sure.
Well, I got to say that you quote Sherrod Brown in your piece, I guess, during maybe what was a banking committee hearing.
Yeah.
And his point is well taken. I'm paraphrasing here, as he basically asked these executives, you know, would we train people to become, you know, medically savvy when they're looking at assessing whether they should get surgery? Would we train people to be able to fix their engine when they're looking to buy a car? I mean, we have a problem where in this country, the car salesmen, the surgeons are basically selling Americans products that they don't need, that are destructive to them. And instead of asking Americans to learn how to assess that, we should step in with professionals and regulate these people. Rachel, it's an amazing piece. I hope people check it out. Thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much.
Rachel M. Cohen is a journalist based in Washington, D.C., and a former American Prospect writing fellow. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, ROFpodcast.com, to hear what you have been missing. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.